This is 6, and it's also Lesson 6. The previous lesson considered the unscientific nature of personality theory in general. In this lesson, we will describe the 3 major personality theories and examine them individually to analyze the validity of each. A study of personality theory is extremely important for several reasons. First, as we have seen, most psychotherapy is based on some personality theory. This approach makes sense since it is only as the psychotherapist works within the context of some theory about human nature, its problems, and how to solve them, that he can treat his clients in a systematic way. The alternative is for the psychotherapist to utilize a hit-and-miss approach of helping people, randomly pulling out tools that seem to have worked for him in the past without having any comprehensive theoretical structure for treatment. He would be like a doctor in a pre-scientific culture who administered various cures that may or may not work, but did not have a general understanding of the human body that would enable him to know why some cures worked and why some did not. Consequently, most psychotherapists base their practice on some underlying personality theory. This does not mean that the psychotherapist is restricted to the insights and approaches to therapy contained in one theory. He may be more eclectic, utilizing techniques from different approaches. However, in terms of his basic understanding of the human being and his functioning, it is difficult to assume more than one primary personality theory to understand the human being and how he functions, since these personality theories are mutually exclusive. Unless, of course, the psychotherapist is willing to live and work with conflicting views. For example, the Rogerian perspective teaches that the therapist must be non-directive in his counseling, conveying unconditional acceptance to the client. As the client experiences that unconditional acceptance, he will, in essence, heal himself. If the therapist assumes this Rogerian understanding of the human personality and takes that approach, it would be incongruous for him to also utilize behavioristic techniques for 2 reasons. First, behaviorism suggests a whole different approach to solving problems. Second, in assigning behavioristic work, the therapist would be violating the non-directive approach of the Rogerian counseling technique. Therefore, for a psychotherapist to maintain any consistency, he must adopt some basic theoretical model, some personality theory, as his basis for helping clients. Therefore, a given personality theory provides the foundation for almost all psychotherapy. And as a result, personality theories are very important. It's important that we study them. The study of personality theories is also important because personality theories provide the foundation for all of the various expressions of psychotherapy. In addition to individual psychotherapy, personality theories are utilized in therapy groups, in writing books on self-help, and in a variety of other ways. Therefore, personality theories have become a very powerful force in our society. In other words, it's important that we study personality theories because they impact our lives and our minds through many different venues. One of the most important reasons for studying personality theories is found in the overwhelming influence that they have had in shaping the mindset of our culture. Though all of the major personality theories have had a part in shaping our mindset, Rogerian psychology has had a tremendously profound and far-reaching impact on the thinking and attitudes of our secular culture and also on evangelical thinking as well. The evangelical worldview is substantially different today than it was a half century ago. This change has been brought about almost exclusively by the assimilation into the evangelical worldview of concepts from personality theories, primarily from the theory of Carl Rogers. And we'll talk about this as we go along. Therefore, we must understand personality theories in order to understand both our secular and evangelical cultures and the influences that are shaping them. A study of personality theory is also very important because they speak to us, these personality theories, where we live. Theories about history or philosophy, no doubt, sooner or later will have some impact on our lives. But the effect of personality theory is immediate and in-depth because it has direct application to our behaviors, our views and attitudes about ourselves and others, our emotions, and our relationships. Therefore, the topic of this lesson is important for us on many counts. However, for the purpose of this course, it is of utmost significance because personality theories shape the counseling process both in secular and most evangelical counseling arenas. Therefore, in asking what aspect of psychology we should adopt in biblical counseling, which is the major question of this course, it is of preeminent importance to analyze personality theory. So we will take the next several moments in looking at the three major personality theories. As noted in a previous lesson, one authoritative source on personality theories indicated that there are in excess of 250 distinctive approaches to therapy. Not only would we be incapable of covering all of these within the scope of this course, but there is no need to do so since only a handful have predominance in shaping psychology and impacting secular and evangelical society. In other words, of the 250, most of them are minor and relatively inconsequential. The ones described here are the most influential. Psychologists frequently refer to the three most predominant schools of personality theory as three forces. The first force is behaviorism. The second, Freudian psychology, or as it's called, psychoanalysis. And the third is humanistic psychology, which has two main contributors, Carl Rogers and Abraham Maslow. First, let's consider behaviorism. The founder of behaviorism was John Watson. But its most popular proponent was B.F. Skinner, who died in 1990. B.F. Skinner's best-known book is entitled Beyond Freedom and Dignity. Behaviorism teaches that the human being consists of a biological computer that has no control over its behavior any more than your computer can control its behavior from a behavioristic point of view, neither can the human being. Rather, the person is programmed by input from his environment and acts in response to that programming. Though the individual may believe that he is making decisions regarding his behavior, the behaviorist teaches that this is not the case. Rather, the behaviorist believes that a specific input will necessarily lead to a corresponding behavioral response. In other words, the organism, the individual, has no control over that response. Behaviorists frequently use animals for their experimentation since they see no essential difference between the functioning of animals and that of human beings, since the human being lacks the capacity to act based on a thoughtful approach to a given situation. In light of this view of the human being, the behaviorist approach to therapy consists of reprogramming the individual by altering his environment so as to produce beneficial behaviors, or to get rid of bad behavior and replace them with good ones. This behaviorist view of the human being robs the human being of his freedom, dignity, and soul. One of the more significant implications of this view is that the individual is not responsible for his actions and therefore is ultimately not a moral creature. On the day that John F. Kennedy was assassinated, I recall analysts as they tried to sort out the implications of this event, and one of the ways they did this was to assert that Lee Harvey Oswald was not responsible for the death of JFK, rather that the society that created a Lee Harvey Oswald bears that responsibility. Likewise, economic developments are blamed for drug and alcohol addiction and promiscuous sexual behavior in today's thinking. Though this may be a very comfortable position when the individual is seeking to escape responsibility, it also has a serious downside. B.F. Skinner in Beyond Freedom and Dignity captures the full import of this position. He describes the traditional view of human responsibility as follows, quote, A person is responsible for his behavior not only in the sense that he may be justly blamed or punished when he behaves badly, but also in the sense that he is to be given credit and admired for his achievements. End quote. In other words, by assigning responsibility to the human being, we not only hold him accountable when he behaves badly, but we also honor him when he behaves well. Skinner contrasts this traditional view with that of behaviorism, which he believes to reflect the conclusions of science. And he does so as follows, quote, "A scientific analysis shifts the credit as well as the blame to the environment," end quote. In other words, along with the comfort of not having to accept responsibility for our actions, behaviorism also deprives the human being of his capacity for love and courage and other noble qualities. Therefore, behaviorism ultimately strips the human being of his distinctive value, placing him on the level of an animal. Though the behavioristic model of the human being still exercises some influence within our society, reducing the person to a biological machine with no unique value has greatly undercut behaviorism's popularity, especially with our society's adaptation of a more existential outlook beginning with the 1960s. The second force in psychology is found in the psychoanalytic system produced by Sigmund Freud, who died in 1939. Freud believed that the human personality is comprised of the id, ego, and superego. The id and the superego are unconscious entities of the personality, while the ego is predominantly conscious. Stated in simplistic terms, Freud viewed the id as being comprised of the human desires, in other words, the cravings of the human being, and many of those cravings, of course, have to do with illicit desires. And the superego is the conscience. That reprimands the id for its lustful expressions or its lustful desires. The ego has a responsibility to referee between the id and the superego. You can see that the two of them are at odds with each other, the id wanting to do bad things frequently and the superego telling the id that it's wrong for wanting to do those things or for doing them when they are acted out. And the ego not only referees between the two of them, but also must consider the realities of life, how the actions of the id are going to impact the human being in practical terms. In other words, if the id desires to look at pornography on the internet, the superego will condemn this behavior. The ego then assumes the task of moderating, mediating between the demands of the id and the guilt feelings produced by the superego, and also by the practical ramifications of viewing pornography, such as the consequences if the person gets caught. Therefore, the ego must implement some sort of resolution to this discord, finding some way to gratify the id, at least enough to keep the id quiet, and yet to deal with the guilt produced by the superego, the superego censorship. And doing all of this and yet finding a way to do it so as to control practical fallout of any behavior produced by the id. Anxiety arises when the ego becomes overwhelmed with these duties as referee. Freud thought that anxiety is heightened as a result of punishment in childhood when the child gives free expression to the id. For example, if a child takes something that belongs to another child and gets punished for it, in the process of this happening, the child is taught that when the id expresses itself, bad things happen. In other words, the person has been taught through this punishment that allowing the id to express itself will lead to painful consequences. As a result, when the adult contemplates giving freedom to the id, he becomes anxious because of these past punishments that he received for similar venting of his id. Freud believes that the increase in pathologies in our society is due to heightened moral restrictions that serve to overdevelop the superego and thus restrict the id, making the ego's role as referee more difficult. In other words, as society becomes stricter, the ego becomes squelched more, and the superego becomes more dominant, and this makes it more difficult for the ego to referee between the two. To cope with anxiety, the human being uses defense mechanisms, which also operate at the unconscious level. They include repression, denial, reaction formation, projection, regression, rationalization, displacement, and sublimation. The problem of the individual then stems predominantly from the unconscious. As a result, the causes of his pathologies are not known to him, and hence there is nothing he can do to remedy them. Here again we find the human being portrayed as a victim. Only in this case, rather than being a victim of the programming of society as with behaviorism, he is a victim of his own unconscious. Consequently, he can only find help by placing himself under the care of a psychoanalyst who is trained to understand the workings of the unconscious. The psychoanalyst will guide him through the long and expensive process of being psychoanalyzed. One of the methods utilized by the psychoanalyst to alleviate the pathologies of his patient is the ventilation of repressed feelings. Neo-Freudian psychologists include a group of therapists that reflect Freudian influence but differ in significant ways. The following are some of the most prominent Neo-Freudian psychologists: Alfred Adler, Carl Jung, Eric Fromm, Karen Horney, Harry Stack Sullivan, and Eric Erickson. Some of these Neo-Freudian therapists may be viewed as a bridge extending from psychoanalysis to humanistic psychology, which is the next psychological force that we're going to be discussing. By a bridge, I'm saying that Freudian psychology has a certain flavor to it, and humanistic psychology, our next topic, has a different flavor. And as we look at these Neo-Freudian theorists, we have a sense that of some movement from Freudian to humanistic. For example, Eric Fromm, even though he is considered by many to be Neo-Freudian, and that's probably the right category for him, he has an awful lot of ideas that reflect the more humanistic approach to psychology. So let's look then at humanistic psychology. The term humanism has two primary meanings. The most foundational one refers to any system in which the human being is the highest entity. The other concept of humanism refers to any system that views human beings in a favorable light. We see, for example, that an evolutionary worldview would correspond to the first definition of humanism because human beings are perched on the highest rung of the evolutionary ladder. However, the evolutionary worldview does not meet the criterion of the second definition of humanism given above because, though human beings hold the highest position in the evolutionary worldview, that worldview leaves the human being as a purely material being without a soul and a being that functions like a biological machine. And therefore, even though he's on the highest rung in the evolutionary model, he also is not flattered by it. Therefore, the first two personality theories presented, behaviorism and psychoanalysis, Freudian psychology, are humanistic from the perspective of the first definition, the human being as the highest entity, but not from the second, in that behaviorism views the human being as a victim of the programming of society, and psychoanalysis views him as a victim of his unconscious, neither of these being a very flattering portrayal of the human being. It is for this reason that the third force in psychology is referred to as humanistic psychology. It is perceived as providing a much more positive view of humanity. As we will see, a careful analysis of humanistic psychology reveals that this is not the case, that it really doesn't project the positive view of humanity that it is viewed to project. Carl Rogers and Abraham Maslow are considered to be the two founders of the humanistic psychological movement. Abraham Maslow, who died in 1970, is noted for many accomplishments in the field of psychology, primarily his hierarchy of needs. Because Maslow did not formulate a comprehensive theory for understanding and dealing with a client, Maslow's concepts do not constitute a personality theory per se. Therefore, under the heading of humanistic psychology, our focus will be on the work of the other founder of humanistic psychology, that is Carl Rogers. But Carl Rogers, who died in 1987, does not have the visibility of Freud. He was probably the most influential psychologist in our society across the past half century, and arguably had a greater influence on our culture during that period than any other person, because many of his ideas deeply impacted our cultural landscape and worldview. A major reason for Rogers' impact is that his ideas lent themselves to popularization, and this is true on several counts. First, they were amenable to use in popular venues. In other words, there were a lot of applications to Rogers' ideas. His therapeutic approach represents a dominant force in the counseling field. Most therapists, including evangelical therapists, use aspects of his therapeutic model in their counseling or adopt his views wholesale. His ideas are also widely used in education. His approach has also provided the theoretical basis for therapy groups of all kinds, thus expanding its visibility and influence exponentially. Also of significance in the propagation of Rogers' ideas is the fact that his approach to counseling has been a predominant force in the self-help movement. In recent years, the self-help movement has grown tremendously, and it's been Rogers' ideas that has been the focal point of much of the self-help literature. Perhaps of greatest importance, his concepts can be used as a model for understanding ourselves and living our lives, providing a theoretical construct to live by. His perspective provides a guide to psychological health, an ethic, a basis for relationships, and an approach to successful living. This applicability of his ideas has led to widespread adoption and use. Many people embrace Rogers' concepts without realizing they are his and without even knowing who he is. In other words, what I'm saying here is because the name Carl Rogers is not popular, that doesn't mean that his ideas are not popular. Many people have adopted his ideas without knowing that they were Carl Rogers' ideas. Therefore, his influence has not been restricted to the counseling office, but has been propagated throughout society as a whole. This represents a major departure from psychoanalysis, which can only be applied professionally. In other words, to do psychoanalysis, you need this trained person, and therefore the applicability is confined to the therapist's office for the most part. Rogers' concepts have become popular not only because they can be exercised in a great number of venues and therefore have received a great deal of visibility, but also because they are highly compatible with the existential mood that has characterized our society across the last half century. As a result, and we're going to see how they are compatible with that existential mood in a minute, but as a result, a tremendous synergy has developed between the Rogerian perspective and our existential philosophical orientation, with Rogerian psychology providing a justification for existentialism and a rationale for its application. The result has been that our society has adopted Rogerian concepts, integrating them into our cultural fabric and establishing them as the very heart of our secular worldview. This development will become apparent as we discuss Rogerian ideas. Rogers' concepts were also quickly embraced because they provide a comfortable approach to life. Thus, people were eager to believe and apply them. Consequently, Rogers' ideas have gained almost universal acceptance in our secular society and form the very core of our secular belief system. Rogers has also had a vast appeal to and acceptance in the evangelical community for all the reasons cited above, plus the belief that his primary concepts are compatible with evangelical society, evangelical theology, and we're going to see how they're viewed to be compatible in a future lesson. Consequently, Carl Rogers' ideas are vastly influential both within secular and evangelical society, impacting the worldview and lifestyle in both arenas. Next, let's consider Rogers' theory. Rogers' theory begins with the assertion that every person is born with a self-actualizing tendency, which is an internal guidance system. If the individual follows his self-actualizing tendency, it will lead him to self-actualization, that is, becoming a fully functioning person, the person that he was meant to be. However, the individual also has a need for acceptance by significant others, a parent, a teacher, someone close to him. If the individual is accepted by significant others conditionally, he will accept himself conditionally, and consequently he will be guided by those conditions of acceptance rather than by his self-actualizing tendency. That is, he will only be able to feel good about himself if he meets the conditions conveyed by significant others. Being guided by their conditions of acceptance will lead to the warping of his personality and pathological behavior. On the other hand, if significant others accept him unconditionally, he will be able to accept himself unconditionally, that is, experience self-esteem that is not based on performance. He can feel good about himself regardless of how he lives. This, in turn, will free him to be guided by his self-actualizing tendency. In other words, if I can feel good about myself regardless of what I do, then I can feel free to do whatever my self-actualizing tendency leads me to do. And this, in turn, will lead the individual to actualization, to becoming the fully functioning person, the person he was meant to be. For example, if parents convey to their son that their acceptance of him is based on his getting good grades, he will invest his time and energies in academic pursuits, when in fact his self-actualizing tendency may have encouraged him toward athletics or music or some other endeavor more compatible with his abilities and interests. His need for their acceptance in order to feel good about himself would drive him away from his natural inclinations, his intuitive choices, and toward objectives stipulated by his parents. This example portrays Rogers' theory in the best light. A less favorable scenario might involve a young man who would prefer to play video games rather than study. His parents, not wanting to warp his personality, convey to him their unconditional acceptance, assuring him that they will accept him warmly even if he spends all of his time playing video games and gets terrible grades in school. The theory assures these parents that their unconditional acceptance will enable their son to accept himself unconditionally, thus freeing him to be guided by a self-actualizing tendency, which in this case presumably would lead him to something more worthwhile than playing video games. However, if a young man continues with his video game habit, the theory demands that the parents trust the boy's self-actualizing tendency, believing that somehow that is the best thing for him. And in any case, it is better to allow him to continue down that road than to warp his personality by imposing their perspective on him. It is better that he be himself, regardless of what that might be, than that he be squeezed into their mold. But what if these parents panic because their son is flunking and begin to convey conditions of acceptance? For example, that they will be happy with him only if he does his homework and pays attention in school. This will lead, according to Rogers, to the warping of the boy's personality and to the development of pathologies. This brings us to the role of a therapist in Rogers' theoretical structure. As noted above, the person who does not receive unconditional acceptance from significant others will develop pathologies. The role of the therapist begins with developing a relationship with the client, thus becoming a significant other to him. In this role as significant other, the therapist extends unconditional acceptance to the client. This unconditional acceptance will enable the client to accept himself unconditionally. In other words, the client will be able to feel good about himself, have self-esteem, regardless of how he lives. And this will, in turn, result in the client's freedom to follow his self-actualizing tendency, which in turn will lead to the healing of his personality.